Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. This is, the first Saturday in April? And it's a little cloudy where I am, but we're going to have a nice day, I think, after the sun breaks out and gets warm. I'm Heather Stark. With me is Deborah Adams, and we are part of the Three Divas. Our third diva is taking a little break, and she'll be joining us again in a couple weeks. But we are the show that talks about current events, violence against women, all sorts of issues from our three different perspectives. And my perspective comes from, I guess, more of an academic one right now. I know that our my co-hosts are also academics, but I seem to be sticking there a little bit longer. And I am currently working on a PhD in organizational psychology, and my focus is on domestic violence and domestic violence issues. And that's a little bit about me. And this is Deborah Adams. Deborah, why don't you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Well, thank you, Sister Diva. My name is Deborah Adams.
And I am located in Southwest Washington. I have a tagline that kind of introduces myself. It is, I have lived it, I've worked it, and, whoops, I did that in the wrong order. I've lived it, I studied it, and I worked it. And the it I refer to is domestic violence. So being a survivor, I then returned to college at a very mature and ready-to-learn age. And while I was doing the academic route, I also worked in a nonprofit, community-based anti-domestic violence agency. So I have studied it through an interdisciplinary view, and that is one thing that I like to do, which is if we have a topic of discussion, is look at it from multiple views. And I like to hear opposing sides as well as the agreeing sides. So sometimes I will debate just for the fun of it.
Yeah. I like playing devil's advocate a little bit, too. I really do.
I think it's fun to stir it up a little bit. Don't you, Heather?
I do, and I think sometimes we're almost afraid to do that anymore in our culture. We want to, you know, we want to share views that other people have around us, and sometimes if we don't share those views, we're a little reluctant to talk about it. So I like to stir it up just like you do, Deborah. Let's play that devil's advocate and see if we can't get some conversation going. Well, we have a special guest coming to visit us here shortly, but first I wanted to talk about this in the news stuff that was happening this week. I continue to be really concerned, Deborah, about the abortion issue and what's happening with the abortion issue in this country. And I think what was in the news this week represents it. The first thing that we saw was a federal court ruling in New York that said that all girls of all ages should have unrestricted access to the morning after pill. And, of course, the morning after pill is the name for the pill that prevents the egg from being lodged in the uterus and turning into a full-fledged pregnancy. And at the same time, we had Kansas passing one of the most restrictive abortion bills in the country. And it is so restrictive that, in fact, in that abortion bill, it says that life begins at conception. Well, that's a pretty conservative view of, I mean, I think even, you know, in the Roman era and everything else, they have always debated when life actually begins. But not very many people say it begins at conception.
And so as we kind of were discussing, Heather, we feel like these are like really polarizing points of view. And what that describes to me, in my mind, that the U.S. citizens, we are either on one end of this discussion or the other. There doesn't seem to be much discussion about middle ground. Where it's New York, it's all, and Kansas, it's nothing, you know. So
yeah.
It's just amazing that we are going through this, and we've had abortion coverage since the 70s.
Yep. Well, Roe
when the U.S. Supreme Court said it was legal. So.
Yeah, yeah, and that was 1973, 40
yeah.
years ago.
Yeah,
years
so
ago.
To be back in this discussion at this ground level point of, you know, of philosophy, and it's kind of amazing to me. How do we go back like this? How do we get
well,
here?
Is
you know?
This, and is this a reflection on, you know, women's status in the United States? I know back in the 70s, yes, I'm old enough to remember that, part of the whole issue around abortion was a woman's right. And the fact that abortion was found to be legal kind of reinforced that, you know what, women have rights. Women have the right to decide these issues. Women have the rights to decide what's going to happen with their own bodies. And, you know, it was right in the era of expanding women's rights. Well, here we are, and at least with the abortion issue, it's shrinking again. So
yeah.
What does that mean for women's rights? Are we going to go back to, you know, where we were 40 years ago as far as women's rights in this country, or I don't know. It just makes me wonder.
Well, and I think it was a topic of huge discussion in our last presidential election. In fact, it was referred to as the war on women by the Republican conservatives, or what someone might call Christian conservatives. So it's sort of started then, but it didn't really start then. It's really been kind of an under-the-radar kind of war on women. I would say, you know, since, I mean, really ramped up, I would say it really started in the 1990s. This whole kind of, as I call it, flying under the radar, where they make these small changes to abortion laws until all of a sudden, it's abortion is now illegal.
Yeah, and there didn't seem to be a lot of press about it. I mean, it just kind of sneaked up on us, I think.
Yeah, it did. It was kind of like we were focusing on other issues such as equal pay for women. You know, in April, there's an Equal Pay Day, and this year I think it's April 9th. And what that means is what we've discovered is that women have to work from January to the following April to earn the same amount of money as a male counterpart in the same position, whereas a male would earnings would be from January to December. A female's earning for that same position would be January to April 9th. And so women have to work long, you know, it really impacts our ability to have savings and retirement and all these things that a lot of people take for granted. So I know that was one issue we were working on was women's equal pay.
Yeah. Well, on the whole economy issue, it seems like if we're not overly concerned, or not overly concerned, but I mean if we're not totally concerned about terrorism, we're totally concerned about the economy. And
yeah.
Those seem like such overarching issues that anything else seems to pale in comparison. You know, what difference does it make if I get pay equity if I'm not getting any pay at all,
right.
kind of thing.
Right.
So I think a lot of us just kind of pushed all those other issues to the back burner, and while they were on the back burner, some people were making stew out of them, I think. You know, Deborah,
yeah.
I don't know if you feel comfortable sharing this, but what are your views on abortion?
I am pro-abortion.
Okay.
I think that women have the right to make that decision for themselves, and especially in view of the fact in our society today, there are so many single female families, you know, they're not two-parent. A lot of fathers are not in the picture. And I think that that's a big decision, that it's a big decision in this day and age to make to even have a child, that
yeah.
there's just so much going on in the cost and everything. So
yeah.
I am definitely pro-abortion.
Well, I'll tell you my opinion. You know, I tend to be more conservative than you do. And when my daughter was a young woman, she came to me and asked me my opinion about abortion. And I said, well, I'll tell you, I think abortion is horrible. I think it's awful. I think it's terrible. However, sometimes the awful and the terrible choice is still the better choice. And I don't think anybody has a right to make that choice for us.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, I don't, if anyone has ever had an abortion, they know it's not something that you do lightly. And they know that it, you know, it can stay with you that you made that decision. And you know, it's not a pleasant experience. And I hope that, you know, what I told my daughter is I hope you never have to make that choice.
Right. I think there's a presumption and an assumption that anybody who chooses to have an abortion is making that decision lightly and frivolously, and that we're, and mostly the burden falls on the woman in these cases, because it is the woman who ends up carrying, you know, the fetus in her body. So the male counterpart can participate in the sexual intercourse and then be gone from the picture. Mm-hmm. And there's not a lot of involvement, or they don't seem to want to get involved in the parenting aspect of it until the child is born. Mm-hmm. And so there's just a whole lot of difficult issues around that. I think that abortion is extremely personal. I think it's not undertaken lightly. It's not a quick fix for someone who woke up one day and found out they were pregnant, that they would just make that decision to run down to the nearest abortion clinic and have an abortion. There's a lot of emotional and religious and cultural thoughts that people have around this issue, whether they support it or not.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not a light and frivolous thing. And I don't know what's going to happen with abortion in this country, but I sure hate to see us turning the clock back 40 years. You know, I really do.
Right, and what that picture brings up to mind for me is that abortion has actually been ongoing since time began.
Yep.
And it will kind of return our society to, you know, the illegal industry. It'll be a black market. It will be in the alleys, in the closed doors. People who aren't trained to do it will be doing it. There will be all kinds of health repercussions, as well as the emotional and cultural repercussions, too, don't you think?
I do. I really do. I know when I was a young girl, abortion was legal in New York, but it wasn't. It was before Roe versus Wade. And I know a lot of young ladies who went to New York to have an abortion, but those who couldn't afford to go to New York, they resorted to whatever they could. I mean, you know, they would take pills. I don't know exactly what the pill was, but I remember some of my friends talking about the abortion pill, and it didn't work. It just kind of made them sick, and you know, and then you think, well, what's going on with that, the development of that fetus, if they're doing all this stuff to try to get rid of it?
Exactly. And the other point of that is there's an argument, well, you can have the baby and give the baby up for adoption.
Mm.
And that sounds easy and, you know, like there's no decision or angst or anxiety around making that sort of decision, too, you know. But again, it's the unintended consequences that come up to haunt people. And people that are adopted, sometimes they don't know it until they're adults, and it creates all kinds of trauma for them. Or mm-hmm. they could be adopted and know of it early, but it still is an emotional thing to figure out what that means, that someone, you know, was pregnant with me but didn't want to raise me, whatever that looks like for them. There's also the fact that we have so many children in foster homes and that are not being adopted. That brings to light to me that that's not, you know, the perfect answer as well.
Well, not only about the child, but having a baby is a tough thing for a body. You know?
Right.
I mean, you're never quite exactly the same after you've had a baby. it takes a toll. And I don't know exactly what statistics are now, but 20 years ago when I had kids, 1 out of 10 women died from childbirth. And that was
yes.
20 years ago. So, you know, it's not like it's some sort of risk-free thing that you can just trot through and say, oh, okay, well, then I'll go ahead and pop out the baby and give it away. No, you basically, you're risking your life if you have a baby. It's
and particularly if you're younger, if you're, you know, if a female is just in puberty and finds out, discovers they're pregnant, that's really hard on a young and developing body to carry a fetus to full term and go through a delivery. There may be emotional and cognitive things that happen, as well as depleting nutrition and the hips and not being wide enough to do that delivery and all sorts of complicating factors.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that you know, most people see nothing wrong with using a seatbelt or, you know, wearing a helmet when you're out on a motorcycle or a bicycle, and yet they see the health risks there. And yet, you know, the health risks, in fact, are greater just driving your car or having a baby. And yet, for some reason, there seems to be such a stigma on a woman caring for her own body by choosing that option. So, I don't know. It's a tough thing to discuss, I think, and of course, the discussion's been going on long before us, and it'll probably go on long after us. But it does, I think, indicate a backward step. No matter how you feel on abortion, I think it indicates a backward step for women's rights. And I think that's pretty tough. Well,
I see
that
our guest has not yet called in. I'm actually texting her while we talk.
Okay.
So,
but
we can go ahead and talk about Three Divas a little bit, Heather, if you'd like to. Why don't you talk about the anthology that you edited?
Well, as I said on the beginning of the show, one of the issues that I'm interested in are the academic studies and the academics around domestic violence. I realized early on when I developed an interest in this field that I didn't have what it takes to be an advocate. I didn't have what it takes to work one-on-one with women who have experienced this. That takes a very special person like you, Deborah, and not me. I just could not do that very well. So I started thinking, okay, what can I do to help in this field? And I decided, you know, I'm a talker, I'm a writer, and I'm a researcher. And so I put those skills together, and I wrote an anthology, or I edited an anthology, called Why Doesn't She Just Leave? A New Perspective on Domestic Violence. And what makes this unique, I think, is the combination of a little bit of research and real-life experiences. I know a lot of survivors write stories. They write their story. This is a little different because it's a number of women's stories. And what we did is we started looking at that. The reason we said, why doesn't she just leave, is because that's the very first question that many people who don't understand the dynamic of domestic violence, they ask that question, like it's just so easy. And it's not easy. It's not easy at all. And, you know, fortunately, if anybody thinks that it's easy, it means that they have not experienced it, and good for them. But for those women who have experienced it, they know that it's much more subtle than that. Domestic violence is not a dump truck running into you. Domestic violence is a choo-choo train just kind of keeping up with you and then surpassing you at some point. It comes up, you start having little twinges of, wait a minute, is this right? Is this normal? And then by the time it escalates to the point where you know you need to get out of there, that it's not a good situation, oftentimes there are many, many things, including threats and children and all sorts of things, lack of support, that keep you in that relationship. And so what we decided in our anthology is that the three main areas that keep women in a relationship are the economics of the situation, the social support of the woman, and I forget the third one. Isn't that terrible? But we basically categorized those, and we sought out women who have wanted to tell and share their story, and we put it together with a little bit of the research, and I think it's pretty good. We've always gotten really good response from it, and it is definitely directed to those people who have not experienced domestic violence, But I've been told that it's also really helpful for women who are going through it and trying to figure out that experience. So,
awesome.
It's called WhyDoesn'tSheJustLeave.com, and it's available on Amazon. And I see, Deborah, that we have our caller.
Yes. Dee, hello. Are you there?
Good morning, ladies.
Hi. I'm so glad you called in.
Yeah, this is exciting, Dee. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
So are you talking on your cell phone, Dee?
I am. Do you want me to call in on a landline?
Yeah, it might be a little bit better.
Okay, I'll do that.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, while we're waiting for that, I would like to mention that I'm also, I'm working on my dissertation. I'm also trying to organize another book called Why Doesn't She Just Take Him to Court? So all of those women who've had experience with the court system and domestic violence know that it's just it can be a really, really tough experience. And again, the people who haven't experienced it, they think that there's justice involved. They think that the courts can solve domestic violence issues. And we all
again, people from the outside looking in assume it's such an easy fix. It's something so easy to do. Just go to court.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
what
that'll fix it. Yeah.
Well, what we know is that's like just the beginning of a long experience, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, hello. You know, 13 years and I'm still going on it. But I think that it's important. So if women have a story that they'd like to share, they can contact me via our webpage and email at Three Women Three Ways. Dee,
yes.
You're back with us.
I am. Is this better?
Oh, much.
Much.
Okay.
Much better.
Well, Dee, thank you for joining us. We invited you to talk to us because you have a particular expertise. And first, why don't you introduce yourself to our listeners? Would you do that for us?
Sure. My name's Dee Koester, and I'm the executive director of the Washington State Native American Coalition Against Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And the short name is Women's Spirit Coalition. We're one of 18 national tribal coalitions, and our office is located in downtown Olympia, Washington.
And how long have you been in business as Women's Spirit Coalition, Dee?
We started organizing in 2002 with tribal advocates in the state of Washington. So we're celebrating our 11th year in operation.
That's really encouraging. And I know that you have a personal and professional tie to your work. Do you want to share any of that with our listeners?
Sure. Well, I am a survivor of all the big fours, which is domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, and dating violence. And so that's my personal passion for the work comes from having survived those incidents and those crimes. And also, I have a long history of working with underserved populations, and I am Native American. I'm Clallam, Macaw, and Quileute, which are three tribes in northwestern Washington State. And have been working with tribal communities for the past 20-some years. So most of my work life has spent developing programs, social service programs, and it's a very long list I won't bore you with, but suffice it to say that I have about 30 years of experience in the social service field.
Well, definitely. And I know that Women's Spirit works with tribes to develop their own program and resources and interventions on domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, and teen dating violence, right?
Correct. Yes.
Right. And so we were planning our schedule for a few months, and we all here on the call know that April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. And there is a disparate effect on Native women and Native communities when it comes to experiencing violence. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, Dee?
Well, in the Native community, Indian women experience sexual assault at 2.5 times the rate of other women. And we believe that, you know, the statistics are underreported. So these are just statistics that come out and through criminal justice agencies. So, but from working in the field, you know, it's rare that I meet an Indian woman who has not suffered some sort of domestic violence or sexual assault. And if they themselves have not been victims, then at least some members of their families have been affected. So the statistics are triple, sometimes more than what other populations of women suffer, and with less resources in tribal communities. So, you know, out in the mainstream world, if the statistics for non-reporting are high, then, you know, it's triple that in tribal communities because there aren't any resources to respond when the women do report. So it's a pretty...
Can I interrupt just a second, Dee?
Sure.
I think this is such an important topic. I want to throw out our phone number for other people. If you'd like to join us and share your experience and have Dee answer your questions, give us a call, please, 646-378-0430. That's 646-378-0430. And again, sorry for the interruption, Dee.
No problem.
Talking about the disparate effect of domestic violence and sexual assault in the Native American communities.
Yes. You know, and we've had, I've been doing this work long enough that I've been able to look back and see progress. You know, they say social change takes 20 years or more. So if you've put in 20 years, you can kind of see that things have improved over the last 20 years. So I've lived long enough to be able to see that, which is good. if you're dedicated to doing the work, you want to see that, you know, things are improving. So in Indian country, let me say first that in the state of Washington, not all tribes have domestic violence and sexual assault programs, only about half. And of that half, many are struggling because there's no dedicated funding to keep them going. They're reliant on competitive grants that run 2 years, and then they may lose their funding or may lose staff. They're usually one or two people in a program. So the burnout rate is really high if you're working in a tribal domestic violence or sexual assault program.
Right, Dee, and I'd just like to interject that that's different from non-tribal domestic violence and sexual assault programs who have stable funding that just gets renewed at the end of the period. For instance, in Washington State, marriage license fees goes directly to the non-tribal DVSA program in that county. And tribal programs don't have any stability like that as far as funding. So when it's competitive, it makes it really difficult to maintain and build a program. Do you think so?
Absolutely. And when I say competitive, I mean across the U.S. competitive, not
right.
just in a state competitive. So a tribal program in Washington State may have a grant for 2 years and then have to reapply, but they're reapplying in a pool of applicants that are from across the U.S., Alaska, and Hawaii. So it's not uncommon to have a program for 2 years and then lose it because the funders want to spread, so to speak, spread the funding around to other programs who have not had it. So it's really not a consistent resource in tribal communities. But we're working toward having that be consistent. So that's one of our public policy issues that we're working towards, having sustainable and funding for all tribal programs and all tribal coalitions.
Gee, does the passage of VAWA with it, I think it had a new phrase in it this time, is that going to help at all?
Absolutely, yeah. And we started working on VAWA, Tribal Coalition Executive Directors, about 2 years ago. And what we wanted was parity in funding from the federal government, the same way that they fund state coalitions. And so that language did, we were able to get it into VAWA, and it was passed. So we'll get some kind of base funding from the federal government, you know, whenever the monies are appropriated and whenever we get that go-ahead. So we're, you know, I can't tell you how happy we are about that, because we've lost sister coalitions along the way to this instability of funding and this competitive process. And also within VAWA, there are some other guarantees for tribes who are, you know, applying for funds under the coordinated tribal assistance money, the CTAS grants. So, yes, VAWA 2013 did help in that regard, and we're just really happy about that.
Good.
So I'd like to talk a little bit, too, about, because we mentioned that April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, how important, Dee, do you think awareness activities such as this month are to the work of serving the tribal communities?
Well, I think first you have to understand where the tribal communities are in their development. And part of it is cultural. So say you're born and raised in a tribal community, or you're an elder in a tribal community, the word sexual is often not spoken, and it's not encouraged to speak about anything sexual in a tribal context. So when, you know, for those of us who don't live in a tribal community, to go in and try and do community education and raise awareness, it's always sort of very touchy the first time we go into a community or the first time that a domestic violence and sexual assault program, a tribal sexual assault program, tries to go in and begin its work. So you really have to start from square one with the community and define your words. You know, what are you talking about in terms of definitions? So you wouldn't just kind of go crashing into a community, you know, waving signs about sexual abuse and rape and molestation, you know, and all of those kinds of words, unless you've spent time first talking to the elders in the community and, you know, people, and approaching it, I guess, from a cultural perspective. So those words were never said out loud. If there was sexual abuse or something happening in the family, it was all very hush-hush. You didn't talk about it. People in the cultural community knew who was doing what, and they would just tell their kids to stay away from that person or, you know, that sort of thing. But the words were never said out loud. So it's interesting coming to work in a culture-specific community because you have to know what the culture is, and you have to know what is accepted and what isn't. So it's been very interesting. But you have to get in and do the community education, and you have to do the awareness piece of the work. So finding a way to go into a community that's culture-specific, that's acceptable to them, so that they will accept what you have to say, is critical.
So do you think it's important to have awareness events like
say April is Sexual Assault Awareness, or is it kind of, it sounds to me like you're saying it's a little bit detrimental in the beginning, at least.
Not detrimental, but it's touchy. You know, you can't, you have to have a foundation built, I think, in any community where you want to go in and do education. For instance, our protocol and the way we started out and the way that's the proper way to begin working in a tribal community is you need to be invited in. Somebody from within the tribal community invites you into their community, and then that sends a signal to everybody else in the community that whomever invited you in has is saying that this is a good person, they have good things to say, and so on. So you would never go into a community uninvited. And I think that's just a real subtlety about doing work in tribal communities, at least from the mainstream perspective, is you don't have those kind of protocols in mainstream. You can pick up a phone, introduce yourself, you know, say what your work is about, blah, blah, blah. But in tribal communities, you need to be invited in.
Okay. So tell me how Women's Spirit goes about then assisting with awareness in the tribes you're working with.
Well, since we've been doing it for 11 years, we can pretty much walk into any community, you know, in the state, and we know people in each of our tribal communities. So because we're not a direct service agency and because we serve 29 tribes, of course, when April or October comes, we don't have enough people power, you know, to do something in every community during those months. So
right.
It's by invitation, of course. And we sort of weigh our resources, you know, where we're going to be during the month. So at the most, I think we have three or four activities that we take part in besides our own, you know, media presence, Facebook and so on, and relaying what other tribes are doing during the month, their activities. So in Washington State, the programs that have been around for quite a while usually have plans every year to do something. For instance, we're going to be up at Lower Elwha, which is my tribe, next week, and we're going to be doing a two-day training, and a half of the second day is an awareness walk. So several years ago, we were doing our introductory trainings up at Elwha, and one of the things that they had asked for, or the tribal domestic violence program had asked for, was help in organizing community events. They had one advocate who was responsible for doing everything, and she needed more help, more people power in getting some of her awareness activities out there, and so on. So what we did was we facilitated the formation of a tribal task force. And so their task force has been operating now, I would say, for about 3 or 4 years. So every year when Sexual Assault Awareness Month comes along, the task force has an activity that they've planned. I think it's April 18th in the afternoon. They're going to do an awareness walk through the tribal land and then have a community dinner. So we're going to participate in that. Now, other tribes do things on a bigger scale, like have a conference where they invite other tribes to come. And Lummi does that every year. They do that twice a year, once in Sexual Assault Awareness Month and once in DV Awareness Month. And then on April 23 and 24, Women's Spirit is hosting with the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center a Sexual Assault Summit. So once every 2 years, that's a project that we do. That's funded with OVW funds. And so we've got about 100 people coming to Spokane April 23 and 24 for that sexual assault summit. And on the first day, of that, we're having a luncheon, and our theme is Forget Me Not. And the idea is to not forget the victims and survivors, but also not forget the murdered and missing, of which there's a high percentage of Native women in the state who are murdered and missing. So we honor them during the lunch, and then we give out our awards. So this year we're giving out five awards, to people that have worked very hard for reauthorization of VAWA and worked very hard to support the tribal domestic violence and sexual assault advocates. So that's our big bang for April's Sexual Assault Awareness Month. Plus, Women's Spirit asked the governor to sign a proclamation recognizing that April 17th is the very first national Native Awareness Day for Sexual Assault Awareness Month. So we'll have that proclamation in hand when we go around to our tribal communities. So those are the main four things that Women's Spirit is doing for Sexual Assault Awareness Month.
Yeah, I think that's exciting, and I think that what you are talking about is the is the outcome of your, you know, almost 11 years in building up your work for the coalition, but also partnering with the tribes. Heather, you have any questions for Dee?
I'm just fascinated because this is not an area of the work that I have studied as much as the two of you or been involved with, of course. But, boy, I'm just fascinated that I guess I just didn't think, and I imagine a lot of people don't think, about how sensitive it is in some communities to get this message out there and to offer help. So I'm just kind of fascinated by your work, Dee.
Oh, thank you, Heather.
So, I think that Sexual Assault Awareness Month has, especially with the advent of social media, has taken on kind of a new wave, I guess, if you would say. I've been doing some research on different events that are going on in April for sexual assault awareness, and on Facebook, I got invited to an awareness event that's all month long, and her purpose is to just raise awareness by painting her fingernails the color teal for the entire month of April. And so she's invited her friends, and her friends invite their friends, and so on and so forth. So that's a pretty low cost, low stress. You know, you don't need a lot of people power, as you said, Dee, to have some kind of awareness event like that. And I think that's very similar to the purple or to the teal ribbon that a lot of national sexual assault organizations have developed campaigns around. What do you think about that?
Well, I didn't know that was a campaign, but I went as soon as April hit, I went and got my fingernails done in teal. So I'm happy to know I'm in with the trend.
You are. Yeah. You are. Have always been a trendsetter, Dee.
And ladies, teal is the just like purple is the color that we rally around for domestic violence. Teal is the color for sexual assault. Am I right?
Right. And the coalition is actually what is called a dual coalition, right, Dee? Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, when we first applied for funding through the Office on Violence Against Women through the Department of Justice, we could sort of define what our coalition was because in Indian country, we're tribal, we're sovereign, so we don't have to really do what anybody else is doing, so we can do what's appropriate for ourselves. So, coming out of mainstream, you have a lot of siloed, and by siloed I mean separate purpose area organizations. For instance, in Washington State, you have a domestic violence coalition, you have a sexual assault coalition. in Indian country, what I was hearing was that within the tribal communities, they don't silo out like that. And they, you know, encompass, embrace things in a much more holistic way, so that you wouldn't send a person to one person for domestic violence and then send that same person to another person for sexual assault services. It's all one service delivery system. And so it only made sense that as a coalition, we become a dual coalition and not claim to be just a domestic violence coalition or a tribal sexual assault coalition. So that's one of the reasons for being a dual coalition. And, of course, when I tackle things, I don't see the limitations of anything. So I try to embrace as much as I could all of the possibilities. So we became a statewide coalition, which meant we served 29 tribes. If you look at other tribal coalitions in the U.S., there are some that are tribal-specific. But I think the difference is that those tribes have big numbers, tens of thousands of tribal members. In Washington State, our tribes are comparatively smaller. For instance, in my tribe, there's about 900 tribal members, as opposed to the Cherokees, North Carolina, who have tens of thousands of members. So you look at those kind of things when you're deciding what kind of tribal coalition you're going to be. I chose the geographical boundaries of the state of Washington because that's what I was used to working within. If you go to North Dakota, South Dakota, the Great Plains area, that coalition encompasses four states. But it's done by the customary areas of the particular tribes that are there. So some of our tribes have multiple bands of tribes with under one name, like Colville and Chehalis have like 10 bands of different communities of people grouped together under one tribal name, like Chehalis, or they're called Confederated Tribes. So it just depends on the geographical area, what are the topics you want to tackle, and that sort of thing. So we had the freedom to define what our service area was. So for us, it's all 29 tribes that are federally recognized within the geographical boundaries of the state of Washington. And we serve, you know, programs. In the beginning, we served some non-tribal programs who provided services to Indian women. And I think that's our secondary population, service population. Our primary is the tribes that have domestic violence and sexual assault programs or want to have domestic violence and sexual assault programs.
Right. So there's different ways they can organize. I do appreciate the way Women's Spirit is organized. And what I've seen is that you are able to convene meetings around specific issues and multiple tribes can attend so that they can show support for each other or learn from each other. And I think that's a pretty effective way to do the work.
We also convene meetings in Eastern Washington and in Western Washington because money and travel is an issue sometimes for the tribal programs since their funding is not always where we like it to be. So as much as we can move around within our own budget and they can move around within their budgets, we try to get together in different ways. 2 years ago, we started doing webinars, which was started out of necessity because nobody had travel dollars anymore. So now we try and do some things via a webinar system or a conference call system that sort of eliminates the need for having those travel dollars. And we can still communicate, you know, on our topics of interest and issues and organizing, using those tools.
Do you think that you might give a little advice to a community that is lacking this kind of service? How might they go about starting a program for Native populations?
Sure. For our service area, anyway, in Washington State, they can just call the office. And, you know, though, to me, that's the most exciting work that there is. We've had great success going into communities that do not have domestic violence and sexual assault programs. And just by meeting with them and having a community forum about what a program does, what it is, what the definitions are, that's the most exciting, I think, part of our work. It was probably about almost 6 years ago now, maybe five, we went up to Colville. And Colville is very isolated, I think, where they are. And they have four different communities that are separate from each other. And we went up and did a community forum. There were probably about 60 people in the audience from that community, and we talked about developing a domestic violence and sexual assault program. And by the end of the second day, the day that we left, they had already formed into committees and decided to move forward with the development of a DVNSA program. So, you know, that was fun, it was exciting, it was useful, it was purposeful, and it was highly rewarding to go into that community and share what we knew with them. So,
Dee, just so people get an idea, the Colville Confederate tribes are in the northeastern corner of Washington State, right?
Correct.
Do they also border, do they cross the
Canada.
Canadian?
The customary areas do go into Canada, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they border Canada to the north.
Yeah.
If someone wants to contact you or Women's Spirit Coalition, how can they do that?
Our phone number is area code 360-352-3120, and we also have a website. It's www.womenspiritcoalition.org. My particular email is ddee@womenspiritcoalition.org, and we'd be happy to talk to anybody, whether it's an individual or an agency or department within the tribe, any member of the tribal council, anybody can contact us.
Okay. So if you need services, that would be the appropriate contact?
For services, we don't do direct service, but we can refer someone to an appropriate service provider.
Okay.
If you're a Native woman on in a tribal community, contact your tribal business office and see if you have a domestic violence or sexual assault program. Other than that, call us. We have a nationwide directory. We can point you in the right direction if you need to receive direct services.
Okay. Terrific. So, Dee, over the years, how has this changed for you personally? How have you developed as a professional and as a committed person in this field?
Wow, that's a big question.
we asked hard ones.
It's 25, 30 words or less.
It's
okay?
Not hard. It's a long story. When I first started, it was because I had been a victim. And so the way that my mind works is if I go through something personally, I want to find out everything about it. I want to know why it happened, what part did I play in it happening, what were the services I could have tapped into. You know, intellectually, I want to know everything about what was going on with me, and I've always approached life that way. So when I first was introduced into the quote-unquote field, it was because I had come out on the other side of being a victim. And I was curious about what was going on, you know, whether my abuser had a mental health issue, what was it that I just lived through? And at the time, I was working as a director of a children and family services center. And my story isn't any different than anybody else's story. At some time, if you stay long enough in an abusive situation, it affects your work. And so it had affected my work, and I was coming down to the ninth hour or the 11th hour where I was going to have to make a choice to leave that person. And so I made that choice, and I looked for another job that was closer to my home. I was working in Tacoma at the time. And I happened to see an advertisement for a community services director at a local DV agency in Thurston County. So I applied, and I was hired. And so then I made that transition into the field. I was actually recommended to get in touch with this DV agency, you know, for victim support services, but instead I ended up going to work for them. So I didn't really ever receive victim support services in that capacity. But I think the way that the journey happened for me, it fit in with my intellect. So I could go, I could earn money, I could be employed, and at the same time I could learn in a professional capacity, not only what I went through, but what other women were going through. And so from there it built. And then because of burnout or whatever, I just didn't really fit within that organization. I then started looking for another job, which led me into grant writing. And I started funding, looking for funding to support domestic violence and sexual assault services. So I kind of went in through that door of direct service, but then quickly sort of backed out that door and went in from a different way. So I have been developing social service programs for 30 years, and so that's where my comfort zone is. You know, direct service isn't for everybody. And I think that if you're curious about whether you can help people or not, certainly direct service is one way to get your feet wet. But again, the burnout rate is high. It's not for everybody. And there are a variety of other things you can do to be of service, you know, and promote elimination of elimination of violence against women outside of providing direct service. So that's my story in a nutshell.
Well, I think one of the things that you just pointed out is really important, too, for anybody who has experienced violence, and that is sometimes you need to just, once you're out of it, you kind of go, whoa, what just happened?
Mm-hmm.
And you do need to take time to process it, to learn about it, to figure out that you weren't alone, that this wasn't just you that it happened to, and that it is something that you can figure out. And I think for most women, after they reach that point, they say, then I want to do something to help out other women. And it sounds
right.
Like you're just a perfect example of that. And you've been doing this in one shape or another for 30 years, huh?
Yep, coming up on 30 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is dedication. That is dedication.
Well, I was one of the lucky ones to find a profession, you know, that was not only rewarding to me, but, you know, one I could obviously stick with. You know, and in and out of that, I went to college. You know, I have a master's degree. So it also led into doing a lot of having subject matter for your college work. So if there's one thing I could say to women who are, you know, on the other side, get an education. For me, getting an education really saved me, and it gave me a way to support myself, and, you know, it just fulfilled me in so many ways. I'll always be a student. I'll be a lifetime student. But, but if there's a life preserver, it's to reach out to that education system and really prepare yourself, you know.
Well, Dee, one of the ways that we usually wrap up our show is with a quote from Deborah, and I think this is a good point to good place to ask about that quote for this week, Deborah.
Oh, I'd be delighted. Well said, Dee. I think Heather and I and Connie Sue, our other diva, would agree with the education piece. So here's my quote. I think you'll find it appropriate. And it comes from Gertrude Stein. She says, "Native always means people who belong somewhere else because they had once belonged somewhere. That shows that the white race does not really think they belong anywhere because they think of everybody else as native."
It has been a delight having you on our show, Dee, and I hope you'll come back and join us again. And
absolutely.
Thank you all for being out there and enjoying the show. Don't forget that you can go to our webpage and hook up with any of our previous shows and join us again next week. We're going to be talking about men in the movement. We are
Three Women,
Three Ways,
Three Divas. Good night, or goodbye.
Goodbye.